iso ongelma, jos mä puhun vain englantia. Koska jos mä puhun molemmat, se on aika pitkä. Puhun jo tunnin verran englanniksi. Yksi käsi, oliko enemmän? 2, 3, 4, 5. Okei, mä yritän aina välillä jotain sanoa, sopiko näin? This is my book that I'm going to talk about. This is a picture of the main street in Helsinki, 1941. Kuva Mannerheimin tieltä 1941. I was born in 43, but if I had been born earlier and lived in Helsinki, I would have walked out on the street and seen this. And I would not have felt very good, because I am Jewish. I thought one way to help Finns understand what the feeling might be like. Some of you may remember there was a movie made in Finland called Reds. And the film was, a big part of it was taken from this point of view, and there was a red star put on top of the National Museum. Muistatteko, että valokuva Redsissä oli punainen tähti kansallismuseon tornin päällä. Ja suomalaiset kyllä järkyttyivät siitä, että oli punatähti keskellä Helsinkiä. It was really a shock to people in Helsinki. They didn't know maybe that a movie was being made, and they saw a red star hoisted up on top of the National Museum's tower. It was not a very good feeling. Imagine if you were Jewish and walked out on the street and saw all these swastikas on the main street. This was not a normal situation. This was a history, an industrial exhibit that the Germans had organized in Kisahalli, in the fairgrounds. Tämä ei ollut ihan normaali tilanne. Tämä oli sen takia, että oli teollisuusnäyttely. Siellä kissahallissa. Kuitenkin. Barry mentioned my book, Konin Ruhtinas, that appeared in 2009. The day before it appeared, Niklas Herlin wrote a blog in which he said, John Simon, a Jew from New York, wrote a book about my father. Niklas Herlin oli kirjoittanut blogin edellisenä päivänä ennen kuin tämä ilmestyi, jos hän sanoi, että John Simon, New Yorkin juutalainen, kirjoitti isästäni elämänkerran. My editor, kustannustoimittajani, happened to have studied Yiddish at Helsinki University. And he said to me, I didn't know you were Jewish. I said, why would you know I was Jewish? We were in a business relationship. You were helping me with my book. And he said, well, you might be interested in a book I worked on. Kustannustoimittajani antoi mulle tämän kirjallisen. Its name in English would be, tell about it to your children. Se kirjoitettiin vuonna 1997 jälkeen, kun Jyrän Persson kutsui puolueen edustajat Pohjoismaista ja sanoi, että Pohjoismaat eivät opeta holokaustia oikealla tavalla lapsille. Jyrän Persson, the Prime Minister of Sweden, had called together representatives of different political parties from the Nordic countries and asked them to find a way to teach about the Holocaust to the children in the schools. He said, we're not teaching about it properly. We're talking about the Holocaust as if it happened over there someplace in Central Europe. But it happened everywhere. It happened in Nordic countries as well, and we should write about it, and we should teach it in the schools. I took the book, thanked him, went home, and started reading it. He had written the finished chapter. I read about the Danes. They had helped almost all of their Jews escape to Sweden. I read about Norway. I knew a little about that as well. There was a government that collaborated with the Germans, but also a resistance. But about half of the Jews of Norway were sent to death camps and did not return. Päätyivät myös kuolemaan leireihin. Sitten tuli Suomi. And when we got to the Finnish part, there were pictures of these three people. Two soldiers and one member of the Lotta Svärd. Kaksi juutalaista sotilasta, yksi Lotta. And the book said that the Germans gave medals for bravery, iron crosses, to these three openly Jewish participants in the Finnish army. Not secretly Jewish, as there were in many countries in Central Europe, but openly. Tässä luki, että ne kolme juutalaista saivat Saksan Wehrmachtilta mitalia urheudestaan. Ja me en halunnut uskoa, koska me tiesin, että saksalaiset eivät antaneet mitalia juutalaisia vain tappoimme. I had trouble believing this because everything I knew and read and understood was that the German army was in the business of killing Jews, not awarding them medals. Mä luin sen varmasti 15 kertaa. I'm certain I read it at least 15 times. Ja sitten seuraavalla sivulla, and then on the next page, came this picture. And it's a picture of a tent synagogue on the Eastern Front, on the Suvari Svir River front, right next to the German 163rd Division. I got to know the son of the man who erected this tent. And he said, yeah, Dad told me that the Germans would come by from time to time while services were being held in this tent synagogue. And they would say, what's going on here? And the answer would be, we're having Jewish services. This is the Sabbath. Oh, that's interesting. Ei tapahtunut mitään. Nothing happened. No one was ever hurt. No one, the synagogue was never defaced. And I said, this is really, really strange. A synagogue next to a German division. You all remember Kristallnacht. 1,000 Jews killed, 100 synagogues burned, and here was one during the war, right next to a German division. Nothing happened. Sorry, I'm going to... Mä varmasti... En pysty kovin taitavasti selittää molemmilla kielellä. Mä aina unohdin, että mitä mä olen sanonut ja millä kielellä. Mutta tämä oli Telta synagoga, joka oli saksalaisen divisionan vieressä Syvärissä. Ja ei tapahtunut näille sotilaille mitään. He kävi joka perjantaina, joka lauantai aamuna. Ei tapahtunut mitään. Saksalaiset tiesivät, kävivät katsomassa, jätti ne rauhaan. Se on vähän huono tämä kuva. I don't have to really tell you all about your own history, but you know that for 600 years, Finland was part of Sweden, 8 eastern provinces of Sweden. Why I mention that is because in 1686, the church law of Sweden said that the Lutheran church was the church of the state of Sweden, and people who lived in Sweden could belong to any church they wanted, so long as it was Lutheran. Nobody else was allowed to practice religion openly in Sweden. And that meant that that was part of the law for the eastern provinces as well. Kirkonlaki 1686 määräsi, että kaikki, jotka asuivat Ruotsissa, piti olla luterilaisen kirkon jäseniä. Se murrettiin vuonna 1724. Silloin Ruotsin kuningas halusi rahaa. Ja hän teki päätöksen, että ulkomaalaiset saivat tulla Suomeen, jos ne maksaisi 2000 riikintaala Ruotsia. Mitä mä sanoin? Sorry. So the Swedish king changed the law in 1628. He said that foreigners could move to Sweden and could keep their religion, but they had to pay 2,000 silver riksdaler to the crown. He wanted money. But they all had to live, all these foreigners, in Stockholm, Nyköping, or Gothenburg, because the police wanted to keep an eye on them, because they were foreigners and suspicious. So none of them lived in the eastern district, in the eastern provinces. Heidän piti asua vain Helsingissä, Nyköpingissä, Göteborgissa. Tukholmassa. Sorry. Kiitos. Tukholmassa, Nyköpingissä ja Göteborgissa. Koska valtion poliisi halusi pitää ne silmässä. Miksi se on tärkeä? Se on tärkeä, koska kun Aleksander I, kaikki ne Venäjän ja Ruotsin sotien jälkeen työnsi ruotsalaiset pois näistä itä-provinseista. Hän antoi suomalaisille mahdollisuuden pitää sen vanhan lain, mitä tarkoittaa, että ei kukaan saanut asua siellä, joka olisi muuta kuin luterilainen. When after all the wars between the Swedes and the Russians finally pushed in 1808 the Swedes back to where they are today in Sweden, Alexander I came to the Diet of Porvoo in 1809 and said to the Finns, you can keep your old laws, your religion, your language, your property, your privileges, Why? He wanted to pull the Finns away from their 600 years ties with Sweden. He wanted them to become loyal to the Russian Tsar, not to their old ties with Sweden. And because the law in Sweden said that anyone who had come as a foreigner to Sweden had to live in those three cities, none of them lived in the east. So none of them lived in Finland. At the time that Finland became an autonomous archduchy of Russia, there were no Jews living in Finland. There couldn't be. Siis 1889, kun Suomesta tuli suurruhtinaskunnat, kun ei voinut olla yhtä juutalainen Suomessa. Mistä ne ensimmäiset juutalaiset tuli? Ja ketkä ne olivat?
Russia.
Right. Kaikki tietää, mitä tapahtui 1492. Kaikki amerikkalaiset tietävät. All Americans know the year 1492. Columbus sailed the ocean blue. When Ferdinand and Isabella sent Columbus west, they also sent all the Jews from Spain and Portugal east, threw them out of Spain and Portugal during the Inquisition. They went to France and Italy first, and then kept moving east, until they came eventually to the Russian border, where Catherine the Great said, "We don't want them in the middle of Russia." So she put up a border there, and the Jews, most of them, over 5 million, got trapped in what was known as the Pale of Settlement. And that's where they settled. They were not welcome in the West, they were not welcome in the East. The Pale of Settlement ran from Lithuania down through Belarus, Poland, down into the Ukraine. And that's where most of the Jews lived when the Nazis decided that they wanted them removed. They lived in what were called shtetls, poor communities. They were not allowed to own property. They were not allowed to run businesses. They were small craftsmen. They were tailors and tanners, carpenters, and did some administration work. They were generally educated people. In 1725, Peter the Great set up recruitment cantons throughout Russia, and including the Pale. And those cantons were districts that had to send a certain number of recruits to the army. Pietari Suuri perusti kantonisti järjestelmä, joka tuotti sotilaita Venäjän armeijalle. Peter said, "We won't take any Jews because they'll never make good soldiers." So no Jews were in the Russian army between 1725. For the next 100 years, none of them was allowed in the army. But in about 1827, Nicholas I was deciding that they had to expand the army. Russia was becoming an imperialist power. It was looking to expand, especially down into the south, and he wanted more soldiers. So he said, we're going to take more soldiers, and we're even going to allow Jews into the army. But we're not going to take them as men. We're going to take them as boys under the age of 13. Why under the age of 13? You've all heard of a bar mitzvah. It's the age at which Jewish boys become members of the adult community. So he said, if we take them before then, we take them far away, put them in special cantonist schools, they'll forget that they're Jewish. They'll convert. They maybe never will be good soldiers, but we'll get rid of our Jewish problem. 50,000 Jewish boys were taken into the army over the next 30 years under the age of 12 and under. They were taken to these schools, cantonist schools, and when they reached the age of 18, they were sent to different military units. And then they had to serve 25 years in the army. Do the math. That meant these young boys would be anywhere from 32 to 36 years away from their homes, away from everything they knew. Cantonisti järjestelmä teki sen, että ne pojat otettiin ennen 13-vuotiaana, vietiin kouluihin, jotka eivät olleet oikeasti kouluja. Ne oli kääntymistuotantolaitoksia. Ne vei ne kauas kotoa. Ja sitten kun ne täyttivät 18, heidän täytyy aloittaa 25 vuotta, 25 vuoden pakopalvelu. The Crimean War. Russia got beaten badly, and their expansionist policies made no sense anymore. They had a big army, they couldn't afford it, and Alexander II said, we need to reduce the army. Everyone who served 12 years can get out. Not only that, they can settle in the place where they served. Krimin sota oli katastrofaalinen Venäjälle. Alexander II, joka otti vallan heti sen jälkeen, leikkasi palvelun aikaan 12 vuoteen ja vapautti kaikki, joka oli palvelut 12 vuotta. Ja hän sanoi, että kaikki saivat jäädä siihen, mihin ne olivat palvelleet. And he forgot to say, except for the Jews. So the Jews who were in Finland, where they weren't allowed to live, were now allowed to live. The law said no. The Tsar said yes. Who do you think won? Not much of a fight, right? The Tsar got to do what he wanted to do. Vaikka juutalaiset eivät saaneet jäädä Suomeen, kun tsaari sanoi, että ne sai asettua siihen, se oli siinä. And from that time on, you had the strange situation of Jews living in Finland where they weren't allowed to live. Minkälainen oli Suomi 1800-luvun puolessa välissä? Sori, että se on se valo, joka tulee ikkunoista joka häiritsee. Se oli vielä aika köyhä maa. 96% ihmisistä asui maalla. Finland at the time was a pretty poor place. 96% of all Finns lived in the countryside, lived off the land. Slash and burn agriculture. A little bit of wood cutting in the winter. Very tough life. And who were the Jews? They hadn't been allowed to live on the land. They hadn't been allowed to farm, and they weren't allowed to farm. They couldn't live in the countryside. Finland said, if the Swedes said they had to live in three cities, we're going to say they have to live in three cities. So they decided that Turku, Helsinki, and Viipuri were the only places that Jews could live if they moved from the garrison towns where they had served. The Jews didn't mind at all because they wanted to live with other Jews because they needed to have a congregation. They needed to have at least 10 males in order to have a proper service. So they all moved to those cities, and the Finns were all living in the countryside. So they had very little interaction. Koska laki määräs, että jos juutalainen, joka oli vapautettu armeijasta, halusi muuttaa, hänen piti muuttaa vain Viipuriin, Turkuun tai Helsinkiin, koska poliisit halusi katsoa, että missä ne olivat. Ne olivat kaupungeissa, suomalaiset oli maalla, niillä ei ollut paljon vuorovaikutusta. Finnish law said that foreigners could only do certain things. They couldn't own land, they couldn't own businesses, they couldn't work in industry, they couldn't join the army. What could they do? They could pick berries and sell them on the market square. They could bake bread and sell it. There were very few things they could do. And most of the things that they could do, the Jews couldn't do. What they could do was to buy, recondition, and resell used clothing, second-hand clothing. Ainoa elinkeino, joka oikeasti sopisi Suomen lakiin sekä juutalaisten kyvykkyyksiin, oli vanhojen vaatteiden osto, kunnostus ja myynti. They ended up on the market square in what was called the Narinka. Today in Helsinki there's still a Narinka-tori, got its name from the Jewish stalls where clothing was being resold. The first 50 years or so, as the Tsars tried to pull the Finns away from the Swedes, the Finns were quite happy. They had been allowed to keep their privileges, allowed to keep their laws, allowed to keep their religion. Remember, the Russians were Orthodox. Generally, when a country, a big country, conquered a small one, they didn't say, you can go on doing things your own way. They said, now you do things our way. But Alexander hadn't done that. The Finns had begun already by the middle of the 19th century. They had a postal system, they had a banking system, they had their own currency. There was even a customs border with Russia. And the Russians began to say, What is this? If we go to Finland, I can't buy a postage stamp with my own money. I can't send a letter with my own postage stamp in my own country. And they began to think we better start pulling back on these privileges. But the Finns said no. Alexander promised us these things. This was not some kind of deal that you can undo. This is our right. And trouble began. Mä luulen, että se on parasta, että me jatkaan englanniksi. Mitä mieltä te olette? Se on tosi vaikea, jos mä yritän puhua molempia samaan aikaan. Mä voin puhua sen jälkeen niille, jotka haluavat tietää, mitä mä sanoin. A Finnish patriot named Arvidsson was supposed to have said, now, we're no longer Swedes. We don't want to be Russians. Let's be Finns. But nobody knew what that meant, really. There was no such thing as a history of Finland. There was no history book. There were no museums with the art of Finland in the galleries. There was no music that was composed as Finnish music. There was only popular folk art and culture, and most of that was considered to be regional. Karelian, Pohjanmaa. So what happened? The Russians began to pull back, and the Finns began to create their national identity. This is stuff anybody who went to school in Finland would have studied plenty of. It was a very important time for the development of the Finnish country, of the Finnish nation. Was there anti-Semitism in Finland at this time? Sort of. Remember, the Finns lived in the countryside. The Jews lived in the cities, which were tiny. Helsinki was 4,000 people after the fire. There were not many people living in the cities, so there was very little interaction. This kind of statement, only a blind man could deny that the Jewish question is a question of world domination. With ironclad determination, Jews advance toward this goal everywhere. They suck in the material forces from around them. We're talking about simple people buying and selling used clothing. There were no Jewish bankers. There were no Jewish politicians. There were no Jewish media moguls. They were poor ex-soldiers who were trying to make a living on the market square. Where did this come from? It came from the propaganda that was being circulated from Germany, from France, from Russia. All this stuff was in the air, but it had nothing to do with Finland. So even though Myrman made a speech like this in the Diet, nobody paid attention. There were never any laws passed. There was never any attempt to do anything except restrict the Jews to having to pay every 3 months for a residence permit. And they couldn't get other jobs. But there were never any violent activities. I don't know if you can even see this, but throughout the Pale of Settlement, there were violent pogroms, all from 1882 onward into the 20th century. Whole villages were slaughtered. In Finland, there was never a violent pogrom. There was never any violence done in this way to any Jews in Finland. It simply never happened. In 1906, right after the Russian failed revolution of 1905, the Russian Zionist Conference was supposed to be held in St. Petersburg, but it was considered too dangerous. So where did they hold it? In Helsinki, because it was safe. So Finland was always basically a safe place for Jews, if a difficult place. A perfect example of this was this strange thing that happened in 1901. This is a picture of the synagogue in Helsinki. It was taken in 1906. In 1901, the city of Helsinki gave to the Jewish congregation of Helsinki, which was not a legal entity, it didn't exist as far as the law was concerned, gave them the land and said, if you build a synagogue there in 5 years, you can keep it. They raised the money, built the synagogue, and that is the synagogue which still serves the Jews of Helsinki today. 7 years later, there was also a synagogue in Turku and a synagogue in Viipuri. How could that be when Jews were not allowed to practice their religion openly? There was not allowed to be a congregation. This crazy thing kept happening from the very time that the Tsar said, you can stay here. If the Finnish law said you couldn't have a congregation, they would quietly go to the Russians and say, we were former soldiers in your army, we served you well, we haven't caused any trouble to anybody, please allow us to do this. Or if the Russians caused a problem, the Jews would go to the Finns and say, we've been living here ever since the 1840s. The Russians are saying we can't do this, but you're the bosses here, this is your country, let us do it. And they always found a way through this crazy situation of the opposition of the Russians and the Finns. Well, you really can't see that picture, can you? That is a picture of some of the first Jews to make their way up to the middle class. I wish there was some way we could cut the lights down and you could see it, but by the time the First World War began, some of the Jews who were the children of people who had started out on the Narenka, on the market square, had managed to do well enough to begin to make it into the middle class. It helps a little, thank you, Barry. I don't know if we can, probably can't get the picture much brighter, no matter what we do. Again, they were not powerful people. There were no political representatives, there were no big bankers, but they were people who had learned that if they couldn't open a shop, what they could do is get a neighbor who was Finnish to agree to open the shop, put his name over the door, and then let the Jewish shopkeeper run the business. There was also an important thing. Obviously, in the old days, when everybody lived in the countryside, they made their own clothing. When they came to the city, if they had money, they would go to a tailor to get their clothing. But when Finland began to urbanize and people began to look for work in the cities, they didn't have money to go to the tailor and they didn't have the time or the wherewithal to make their own clothes. So they went to the Narenka and that's where they got their clothes and they were very happy to have that service. And the Jews who ran the Narinka began to realize that maybe there was a market for off-the-rack, ready-made clothing. And when World War I came, and soldiers, they needed a lot of soldiers, all those soldiers got ready-made clothing, ready-made underwear, ready-made suits, uniforms. And that created the capacity to make clothing, which at the end of the war, then suddenly became a commercial option. During the war, the Baltic Sea was locked down. Finland could not export anything to Southern Europe or Western Europe. The only places they could export to were Russia and Sweden. Russia was an important market. They took a lot of paper and pulp and cloth, textiles. Sweden didn't need anything really that Finland had. Sweden made all the same things that Finland did, so it was a very small market for Finland. But then came 1917, the Russian Revolution, and the Russian market was locked down. So Finland was really in a tough way. A lot of companies went bankrupt. A lot of the Jews that had started to make it into the middle class lost their money. But there was obviously one silver lining, and that was that the Finns all looked to the east and said, hey, those guys are fighting with themselves. Guess what? We're independent. And Lenin, who had said that peoples had a right to self-determination, had to agree. So without firing a shot, Finland became independent December 6, 1917. But then came the consequence, the awful civil war that mirrored the civil war that was going on in Russia. War lasted 3.5 months, at the end of which 20,000 were dead. 20,000 had either fled or been driven across the border to the Soviet Union, and 80,000 were in prison camps, horrible camps. And then the Spanish flu came and killed even more. What was needed? Those workers couldn't stay in the prison camps. If they stayed in the prison camps, there would be nobody to build the new country. Finland was suddenly independent, but it needed to do everything. It needed to build. The job of the government was to put the pieces of Humpty Dumpty back together again, to make it possible for the workers and the owners to get together and begin to start commerce. They need to begin to create an education system, to build an education system that would allow the government to run. And for the Jews, it was a time for them to come out of their status as foreigners. What happened in 1909, the Senate had passed a law offering to make foreigners, to give foreigners the opportunity to become citizens, including the Jews. The law was passed overwhelmingly by the Senate. But in 1909, any law had to be signed off on by the Tsar. That law was never sent to the Tsar and never signed, so it never became a law. The history books say that Finland and Romania were the last countries in Europe to offer citizenship to Jews. The truth is, and you have to decide for yourself whether you think the glass was half empty or half full, among the very first laws that was passed by the Finnish government when it could make its own laws without asking anybody's permission, was that these people could become citizens. For myself, I don't see that that's a case of half empty. I think that Finland offered the opportunity for its Jews and its Tatars and others to become citizens as soon as Finland could make its own decisions. And so what did they do? The Jews began to organize into different groups. They started sports teams. They started cultural and musical organizations. They had their own Yiddish theaters in all three of the cities. They even had a school in Helsinki. In none of those pictures will you see any non-Jews. They were all inward-looking organizations. Why? Because they still lived together, they still lived right around the synagogue, they worked together, they still spoke Yiddish, not Finnish, not Swedish. Some of them were beginning to learn Swedish in Turku and Helsinki and Finnish in Viipuri. Finland was becoming wealthier. It was becoming a major exporter of wood and pulp and paper products. Helsinki was beginning to become a modern city. Instead of wooden houses, there were more and more stone buildings with electricity, indoor plumbing. You had even had tramways running in the streets and a few cars. And the Jewish merchants were now able to open stores under their own names. So Mannerheimintie, which was still known as Lantinen, Heikintie, had rows of Jewish dry goods merchants and clothing stores. The 1920s, late 1920s and early 1930s was a period of radicalism throughout Europe and even the United States. There was a real battle going on among three tendencies: communists, fascists, and those who wanted to stay the middle path and have a democracy that could go either way. Communists and fascists arose in Finland, but they never gained real currency in the government. They never gained real power. They were just marginal threats. By 1933, National Socialism was installed in Germany. But in Finland, you had, you had some acts of bravery which pulled the discussion back towards the center. The 10th anniversary of the white victory in the Civil War. And you saw the head of the Social Democrats, Reiner Tanner, reviewing the troops who were essentially the White Army, because that was Finland's army at the time. You had him reviewing the troops at the risk of his own reputation. He was saying, 10 years is enough. We have to stop asking all the time, which side did your father fight on? We're all Finns. 5 years later, you had the Mäntsälä insurrection. Members of the Lapuan Liike picked up guns, went to Mäntsälä, and tried to interrupt a socialist workers' meeting. President Svinhufvud, who had marched along with the right-wing Lapuan Liike before, said, called the head of the militia there, and said, tell your men to put down their guns. This is not the way we do things here. This is a parliamentary democracy. And the answer he got was, no, we're not going to do it. We're not going to put our guns down until you drive all of the communists and the socialists out of the country. So Svinhufvud got on the phone, on the radio himself, and said, men, you know who I am. You know that I've marched with you in the past. I'm telling you to put your guns down and go home. And they did. So both on the left and the right, you had men taking strong stands saying, this is a parliamentary democracy. We are not going to solve problems by extra parliamentary means. The three leaders that I think were most responsible for seeing that the country did not fall to the sway of radicals on the left or right were, interestingly enough, someone who had been a radical rightist at the time of the Civil War. He not only led the White Army, but Mannerheim wanted to have to install a monarchy in Finland. Tanner had been a founder of the Social Democrats, or Socialist Party of Finland. Son of a brakeman, who worked his way through school, went to law school, and was a founder of the co-op movement. An aristocrat who had served in the Russian army for 30 years and ended up as the head of the armed forces and really was the architect of Finland's defense forces. And then you had Risto Ryti, who was a banker, son of a gentleman farmer, basic economic liberalist, who became president of Finland and guided it through the war. So you had all the potential for one to take the country hard right, one to take the country hard left, and instead they reined in their forces and said, no, we are going to put the country back together. We're not going to tear it apart again. One civil war is enough. Meanwhile, the Jews were beginning to get out of their inward-looking and inward-acting society and get out into the larger society. The first Jews were able to study and become doctors and lawyers. Jewish artists, like the Menuhkins, otherwise known as the Andrews, the Manuel, what was it? Jack Manuel and his band. Three brothers and a sister. Rosie Andrews, who was another Menuhkin. Very famous entertainers in the 1930s. Elias Katz won several medals in the Olympics, alongside Paavo Nurmi and Ville Ritola. The Jews were getting out and were becoming part of the larger society, no longer so inward-looking. But as we get closer to the Second World War, danger signs came. Finland was the last country to have a no-visa travel arrangement with a country in Central Europe, with Austria. And so Jews who were trying to escape from Czechoslovakia, Germany, Austria, would try to come to Finland because they didn't have to wait to get a visa. And then they would move on to the United States or to Palestine, wherever they could get to. August of 1938, the weekly boat bringing refugees from Germany was turned aside by then Interior Minister Kekkonen. He said, we don't need a Jewish problem in Finland. let somebody else solve it. We have our own refugees from Inkerima in Eastern Karelia. We don't need these guys. And he turned the boat away. Three of the people on board jumped overboard and drowned rather than go back to Germany. There's been some new research about what happened to the people who were on board. For a long time it was thought that probably all of them died in the Holocaust. Now there's apparently some news that some of them survived. I haven't had a chance to read that yet. 1939. The Olympics were supposed to be held in 1940 in Tokyo. But by 1939, Japan was at war with China. And it was clear that they couldn't have the Olympics there. So the Olympics Committee took them away from Japan and awarded the Olympics to Finland. Finland already had started building a beautiful new stadium for the Olympics. In 1939, it was opened in a special track meet. At that track meet, Abraham Tokatsir, here, finished fourth in the 100-meter dash. See if you can see the picture well enough to understand what that means. Here's the finish line. Here's Tokatsir. You see space here. You see space here. And here's the guy who finished fourth. He clearly won the race. The next day, both Helsingin Sanomat and Uusi Suomi published pictures, this picture, and said there was a mistake. They announced that he finished fourth. That was wrong. Finnish Sports Federation corrected that mistake 2 years ago. Until then, they said, we can't change the results of a track meet. People began to wonder, was there a message in that? Was there perhaps a German delegation in the stands and the Finnish government didn't want to give the wrong message by having a Jew win the race? A year later, the Olympics were taken away from Helsinki too because it was impossible to have any Olympics in 1940. The next Olympics were in 1952 when they were in Helsinki, but there were no Olympics during the war. You can see in this picture of a track meet where Finland invited Sweden and Germany, the Minister of Sports here from Germany giving the Nazi salute, and you can see two or three others in the background with their arms raised, if you can see the picture. The pictures are in my book, so you can see it there. August 26th, everybody knows that Germany and the Soviet Union are headed for war. And suddenly, the foreign ministers, Molotov and von Ribbentrop, meet and sign a non-aggression pact, saying that we will not fight each other, and if anybody fights one or the other, we will not support them. And everybody says, what's going on here? Well, what was going on was simple. Stalin wasn't ready to fight, and Hitler wanted to attack only to the west and not have to defend himself to the east until he was ready. What was not said was that there was a secret protocol which defined where all the countries in between the two were to be given. Who was to have control of those countries? And you can see here that Finland was given to the Soviets. It only took about 10 days for that pact to become public information, because on September 1st, the Germans attacked Poland, took half of it, and stopped. Then the Russians counterattacked, went up to the same line, and stopped. And everybody said, uh-oh. Did a little research, and this pact, this protocol came out. So they realized that the countries in between had been divided up between the two. Then we begin what's called in this country the Second World War, but was really three wars in Finland. First, of course, came the Winter War. We now know that the Mainiland Laukaukset, the shots that were fired at Mainila that killed four Russian soldiers and wounded nine others, and that the Soviets said were fired by the Finns, were in fact fired by Russians. They killed some of their own soldiers in order to blame the Finns. 4 days later, 16 cities in Finland were attacked, and Russian troops poured across the border. 3.5 months later, the Finnish troops were exhausted. Country was basically out of food, out of ammunition, and for whatever reasons, they managed to have fought the Russians to a standstill, and Stalin agreed to an interim peace. The price? Oops. The price was 11% of Finland's land and 12% of its population. You all know that part of the history. We then went into an interim peace. What had happened to the Jews during that war? During the time when Jews were still trying to become citizens of Finland, they sent a petition to the Senate in which they said, "We were once soldiers in the Russian army. We're now old, we're going to die. But our children, our grandchildren have been born here, and they want nothing more than to be good citizens of this country. And we believe, down at the end, that if they are called upon, they will fulfill their duty as citizens, even to the point of the ultimate sacrifice, giving up their lives." When they were called to fight, the Jews went the same as everybody else. Served in the Winter War, and more of them died per capita as part of their group than any other group in Finland. 15 soldiers died. You can see 13 of the graves here at the Jewish cemetery in Helsinki. The other two were not able to be brought out. That's the Independence Day commemoration in 1940. In 1941, Finland was facing a very severe situation as far as food was concerned, as far as fuel was concerned. They had no weapons with which to fight if the Russians were to come a second time. And the Germans said they couldn't help them. But you can see here, you have Russian control or Soviet control all through here, and you have German control all down the west coast. So even if the United States or Great Britain had wanted to help, there wasn't much they could do. They couldn't get across there. Finns and the Swedes tried to maintain neutrality, but both the Soviet Union and the Germans said, no, that would break the agreements we have. Where could they get help? It looked like nowhere. Until early in 1941, a captain in the German army showed up at Mannerheim's headquarters and said, we know we're not supposed to help any enemies of the Soviet Union, but we think Finland's being given a raw deal. We will sell you food and weapons if you will allow us to send troops across Finnish territory, first by sea to Vaasa, and then by land up to northern Norway, where we have troops and we need to reprovision them and bring them home occasionally for rest and recreation and send fresh troops up there. If you allow us to do that, we will agree to sell you weapons and food. The Finns desperately needed both and accepted. From that time on, Finnish arguments that they were still neutral really don't hold. So from the beginning of 1941, Finland was beginning to plan with the Germans what eventually became Operation Barbarossa, the attack that went from here all the way down to here, a blitzkrieg attack into Soviet territory. And the Finns agreed to play a role here. This was a very different kind of war for the Jews of Finland. They knew what had been going on in Germany. Nobody knew about the death camps. The death camps were only just beginning at this time. But they knew about Kristallnacht. They knew about the deportation of Jews from the Baltic countries. They knew that there was a lot of ugly stuff going on. They all had relatives somewhere down in the south, in Poland, in Lithuania, wherever. Hitler, who almost never left Germany, flew to Imatra to celebrate Mannerheim's 75th birthday. We have someone in the audience who said he was present at that event.
No, my dad was.
Your dad was, sorry. Here you see Himmler, the architect of the final solution, the death of 6,000 Jews being rowed across a lake by the Prime Minister of Finland, the Foreign Minister of Finland, sorry, Jukka Raatinen. It was a very tough time for Jews, but they all went back to fight. And people sometimes ask me why. Well, I see three reasons. One is they had fought in the Winter War like everybody else had. And when the call came, it was to go back to their old units. It wasn't a new thing. They were recalled back to where they had fought. So it was normal for them to go back to where they had been. Secondly, they were the grandchildren of military men. And I think they probably had some pride in that, that they had fought and that they were now considered soldiers as well. But most of all, they understood that if they didn't go, whatever the reason, it would give the Nazi sympathizers in Finland a chance to say, see, you can't trust them. They don't deserve to be citizens. When the time comes, they don't show up. They understood that, and they understood that it would put their families in danger as well. So as far as I know, everyone who was called went back and fought. 267 of them. San Samuel Mashalbat, who was the son of the rabbi of Vipuri, was not one of the ones who fought. He was he had a congenital condition which made it impossible for him to be in the army. He was crippled. But he said, my thinking went like this. If Germany wins and we are destroyed, Germany would direct its hate only at the Jews and the Gypsies and the like. But should the Russians win, it would be a disaster for the whole country, and then we would all be equal. So you could see this was kind of a way in which the Finns felt, the Jews felt that they were earning their citizenship in Finland. They were proving themselves, we would all be equal, and we are all in there fighting together. There is one ugly stain on the reputation of Finland with respect to the war. It wasn't that they helped plan the Operation Barbarossa and that they fought alongside the Germans. I think that can be explained pretty well by history. In 1942, November, Arno Antoni, who was the head of this of the state police, brought a bunch of prisoners into the state police headquarters on Ratakatu in Helsinki. Among them, these eight Jews. The rest were Estonians, and I think a couple of Latvians. They were charged as criminals. Their crimes were things like not having renewed their residence permit in time during a time of war. And certainly, the one-year-old probably wasn't much of a criminal. The Jewish community heard about it. They were to be herded quickly onto a boat and sent to Estonia and handed over to the Gestapo. There was no Gestapo in Finland, but they had a Gestapo headquarters in Tallinn, and they were to be sent to Tallinn. The Jewish community heard about it and rushed out to find a minister who could stop this action. It turned out that everybody was away hunting in the countryside, except for one. He said, I don't like this, but I'm not responsible for the police. I can't step over and say they can't do this. What I will do is say no action can be taken until Monday when everybody comes back from the countryside, and then we will all decide what to do together. So, on Monday, when all the ministers met, they went to a kind of iltakoulu, an evening meeting behind closed doors, quickly. And at that meeting, Antoni said, I'm responsible for these guys, they're criminals. And his boss, Toivo Horeli, the interior minister, said, my guy says these are criminals, this is a criminal action. If you override it, I'm going to quit. I'm walking out of the government. And if I resign from the government, I'm taking my party with me. And if I take my party with me, the government will collapse. And we're in the middle of a war, and it'll be your fault. Apparently, one member of the Social Democrats got up and said, well, if you do take them, I'm going to resign, and I'm going to take my party with me, and then it'll be your fault. So they were in a kind of stalemate. And the compromise they finally reached was, this is a police action, we won't stop it, but there will be no more police actions of this kind ever. Those eight were deported, along with some of the Baltic refugees. They were sent to Auschwitz. Seven of the eight were killed. One was put in a work detail and survived. Today, in Helsinki, there are 7 Stolpersteine, these stones that are put down, these plaques that are put down to commemorate the buildings from which these people were taken and sent to their deaths. There are thousands and thousands of them all over Europe. In Finland, there are 7. The third war, you all know, was the Lapland War. After Finland withdrew from its agreement with the Germans, made peace with the Soviets, the Soviets demanded that they drive the Germans out of Finland, which they did with a great deal of difficulty. The Germans were leaving anyway, but they had to hurry them up. Otherwise, the Soviets would have come in to do it for them, and then they never would have gotten them out. So there was no choice but to do that. Germans didn't like it, of course, and so they laid waste to all of Lapland as they went, destroyed everything in their path. Independence Day, 1944. The war in Lapland was still going on, but it was nearing its end. Mannerheim, by this time, was president. And instead of going to the fairgrounds to give a speech to the whole country on Independence Day, he went to the synagogue in Helsinki and gave them a wreath in honor of the sacrifice that the Jews had made on behalf of the fatherland. If you ask anyone in the Jewish congregation in Helsinki today about it, people will say, Mannerheim loved the Jews. He said, over my dead body will you take any of my Jews. I don't think that happened. I think Mannerheim was a very pragmatic politician. I think he understood the following things. Number one, if you are a small country and you're fighting huge, overwhelming enemy, you can't sacrifice anyone. It has to be all for one, and one for all. So he understood that if he had allowed Jews to be taken away, the next thing would have been that maybe the Swedish speakers would have said, maybe he doesn't like us either, or somebody doesn't. Certainly it wouldn't have been Mannerheim, but somebody, there would have been the risk that different groups would have felt, maybe we're going to be the next ones to go. And the whole war effort would have collapsed. The other thing he knew was that after the war, Finland was going to have to find a way to ally itself with the West. And he knew that the West would measure countries in part by how they had treated their Jews during the war. So he was sending a message basically to us here, saying, look, we've done everything we can to protect our Jews. In fact, at the end of the war, the Jewish committee from New York asked the congregation in Helsinki to make a statement about how they were treated during the war. And they said, oh, the Finns, you know, protected us and were wonderful, because they understood the same thing, that the country needed to know, that the world needed to know that Finland had not betrayed its Jewish citizens. These are the figures from Yad Vashem, which is the official museum of the Holocaust in Israel. Somebody said to me today, as has often been mentioned, oh, Bulgaria saved all its Jews too. Technically, that's true. As far as we know, no Bulgarian Jews were killed in the Holocaust. But Bulgaria was responsible for Thrace and Macedonia, where they helped to send 11,000 Jews to their deaths. in the death camps. So I discount that. I don't think that zero means anything next to them. I don't like the seven that's next to the Jewish figure, the Finnish figure. I wish it were not there, but it is. But seven's a lot different from 11,000. It was not the policy of the Finnish government to deport anybody. It was a situation where they really couldn't find a way around it. But otherwise, they made sure that no Jews were deported. And not only that, after those eight were deported, Finland began to grant citizenship to Jewish refugees who had stayed in Finland during the war, while hundreds of thousands of German soldiers were on Finnish soil or passing through Finland. No other country did that. So it was clear that it was not the government's policy to deport anybody. Those of you who have bought the book or who do buy it or who read it will find that it's not just this history that I have been giving you. It's also a novel. It's the story of three generations of one Jewish family and what they went through from the time that the first boy was kidnapped from the Pale and taken away to a Cantonist school until the time that his grandson fights in the Finnish army in the Second World War. Why did I make it a novel? Does anybody know who that is? Nobody. That's Jefferson Davis. He was the president of the Confederate States of the United States. In other words, the president of the southern states that seceded at the start of the Civil War. Quite an important person in American history. It doesn't matter what the group is, almost nobody knows. Usually there's one person who knows in the group. Do you know who these people are? Yes? How do we learn our history? Do we learn it just from history books? I think the history that we learn and that we really hang on to is when we can identify with people. When we see it through a movie, read it in a book, hear it in a story from somebody who actually lived it. We learn things when we can make an emotional attachment and really hang on to that story. So I wanted to tell a story, not to write a history. So when you read this, you'll find the history there, but it's there because most people don't know the history, and I have to have that there as a context for the story. I bet most of you have seen this one way or another, right? Last 2 years, Finland, the happiest country in the world. I've been living there how long? 46 years? 36 years. I don't see it as the jolliest place you can possibly be. But what do I understand by this? I understand that if you build a country on respect for the rule of law, that you don't allow the radicals to take control, that you continue to operate according to the rules that you've set down in a rational manner. If you understand that your society is stronger if it includes everybody instead of excluding some and building up the others. Then you can focus on real problems, like building a good school system or a medical system where you don't have to worry that tomorrow if you get sick, your whole family maybe is going to be bankrupt. you can begin to make a society where you have a chance, each person has a chance to build his own happiness. That's how I understand Finland today. It's not the perfect place. It's not paradise. But it's not a place where you have to fear that things are going to happen to you. You have a chance to be the active one and make things happen the way you want to. Thank you.